butter, and then there's some nå sier jeg det på engelsk and then så det brennesle og så det litt løkhjort og korsknapp og så det en salat på toppen med russekål litt engkarse skvallekål og så det litt gaukesyre og granskudd så da kan jeg egentlig take one. Some are invasive, not all of them.
Brennesle, Verike.
And like, we walked by this, down by the road, there was like 10 bags of this russekål that they have tried to take out. I can go there, yeah.
Men det, jeg ser ikke det, dette forblemmer jeg. Det bare dekorasjon, eller
sånn. Ja, den skal vi ha på dessertene.
Ja, så det kan man nok spise.
Ja. Smaker ikke så veldig mye, men...
Men det veldig er veldig fint.
Ja. Ja, det var mange.
While you're eating, or oh, maybe you're already finished, but we will play the recorded conversation between Randi Igor and Tom Sandori. There was a message being sent back and forth, messages between Randi and Tom, and it was about 40 minutes long, cut down to 20 minutes, but if you're interested in hearing the whole conversation with all the stories, we will also have it on our webpage.
Det är two experiences that I've had this, and that has been really important. And the first one was when I once interviewed Arne Johan Mettlesen at the University of Oslo. So we were sitting in the cantina nearby a large window where we could see three birches. And I wanted the professor to talk a little bit about his knowledge about philosophers that had taught about dance or movements or dynamics or processes in biology as expressions in themselves, as something carrying a meaning, maybe a meaning that wasn't fully graspable for us, but that we could sense. But that lesson, he wanted us to watch the trees outside. So we sat still a little while, and we were looking at the birches, and it was really windy that day, and some rain. So they were moving, and the professor told me that even if we say that the trees are moving, we think that the force that is moving them is the wind. And it's quite illustrative of how we were looking at nature, that we think that the wind is the only force there. So even if we know that the trees are alive, we don't really ask ourselves the question if the trees have any response to the wind or the rain. And I was so struck about this because I thought about myself as a person that was fully aware of that plants and trees are alive, but I had also never pondered or wondered about if the tree make resistance to the wind, if it moved the leaves in a special way, if it positions itself differently according to the weather, if it likes the rain. It's alive, so there must be some kind of sensory reactions in the tree. Then, just from sitting there with Vettelsen, talking to him and watching trees, suddenly perceived the environment as much more alive and really larger. So I wanted you to hear that, and hopefully, if you want to, you can send me some stories from your part.
And by the way, Tom, did you know that some scientists at CERN have recently found out that the substance that we humans recognize as the smell of pine trees, it's called alpha-pene, actually takes part in cloud seeding. So the pine trees, they produce a substance which later is part of forming clouds. I think that's super exciting.
Thanks so much for these questions and for these stories. That's fascinating. I have many crow stories. I guess one of the most formative for me was not too long ago, but it was about 20 years ago, after a big bushfire in Canberra, where I was growing up, that burnt a big hill that was a nature reserve that was behind my parents' house, and it really took out all of the grass and a lot of the trees. And for months afterwards, of course, it was a black landscape, and we worried about the animals that had escaped the fire that lived up there. So I started taking, as did my parents and other people in my family, taking containers of water and fruit and other food up the hill most days to try and leave for the kangaroos and others. I don't know if this was necessary, probably wasn't, but it felt like the right thing to do. But what happened with the ravens for me was most important, and that was that they very quickly figured out who we were, and they didn't have to be able to see the water or the food in backpacks. They just knew that it was us, those people coming, and they would follow us from right down low as we crossed the street over into the nature reserve. As we moved through the nature reserve, they would follow and be waiting, of course, for the food. So it was that experience of being recognized that I found really interesting, and that repeated itself again and again in my interactions with corvids over the years in different parts of the world. But I think the other thing I took away from that was that that while those experiences can be gateways into connection and into curiosity, and I think that's incredibly valuable. For me, that whole experience of being watched by crows was enriched infinitely by an engagement with the scientific literature and by talking to behavioural biologists and others who had actually studied these elements of corvid life. So based on that kind of research, you know, we can say with confidence that crows are recognising individual humans, and they're even passing that information on to other corvids, to their, often passing it on to their young, who see their parents perhaps have a bad interaction, or see their parents scolding, calling out loudly and swooping down at problematic humans. Even in the nest, young crows will see that, and they will remember that, and they'll remember the face of that individual, and they will hold it against that human for some time, it seems. So we know that that is the case. It's not just a kind of anecdotal observation of somebody like me who feeds crows. They're aware, corvids, of what we're looking at, and they pay attention, they look at what we're looking at to see if it might also be of interest to them. And we know also that they don't like being looked at themselves by us. They're aware of that too, and it makes them uncomfortable. So I think for me, all of these kind of personal experiences are made so much richer in a way by diving into that, those kinds of scientific and more technical literatures that that help us to think about, think critically about what we think we're seeing when we interact with other species. So that while the speculation is fantastic and fascinating, I think there are ways in which that speculation can be brought into dialogue, and not just with scientific knowledges, but with the knowledges of other really interested people who make it their business in one way or another to pay attention to what plants and animals and others are doing, whether it's hunters or farmers or indigenous peoples or many artists who are doing that kind of close observation, or philosophers even. So I think bringing those into dialogue with our own experiences creates, for me at least, the most rewarding and enriching sense of the other beings that we share this world with and what it is that they're up to.
Thanks so much, Tom, for wanting to share and for also sharing. I like the thoughts that you have in regard of my stories, and I love the way that you describe it as being responsive, or this responsiveness of animals and plants, and also the mindfulness. I think that we tend to often forget that the animals and plants around us can respond, and maybe it's quite important also to consider that as a point as we're here. The group of artists here in Oslo working with the protected area around Østensjøvannet. I guess that conservation also brings forth some questions around, you know, management or use, as one can put it in Norwegian, and, you know, restrictions or the opposite somehow, like we just leave big areas alone. And that maybe both these ways of, one, you know, viewing most of the natural world as purely resources for us, the humans, to use, and the other, conserving and protecting areas so humans should not be allowed to use them, just watch it or use it as for, you know, recreation. I think maybe both those views, as they might seem as opposites, are still, you know, enforcing the division between nature and culture, or humans and animals, and that the bonds and this responsiveness is sometimes still, you know, overlooked. Or in my project here around Østensjøvann, I wanted to focus on stories. So when I sit there and I talk to you, I haven't really planned which story to share, but as I listen to your beautiful story about caring for the animals after the fire near your parents' house, I was somehow picturing a station where humans could be watched by birds. So it's not a bird watching station where we would bring our binoculars, but it would be the other way around, a place you could be to be watched by birds. But then I thought like maybe all of the area around Özmüşivan is such a place. It's a place where you're watched by birds because there's so many birds. So it's just to notice this maybe might be a first step for many people to open up for the responsiveness. And then also your own reactions, I think. It's not so clear often how to react towards the liveliness of a tree or, you know, animals. As you say, the crows don't like to be watched. I think humans are often watched by birds without noticing it, which somehow is also kind of a beautiful thought, but maybe it changes more if we did notice. I mean, change the way that we view nature, but also our own place within the natural environment. Then I wanted to ask you, Daria, about, because I saw that the project you're taking part in here in Oslo mentions shared meaning. So then I was thinking, is this which shared meanings? Do you have a story about shared meaning? I would be quite curious to hear your perspectives. Could also be just thoughts, of course, but if a story pops into your mind, I would be very excited about that. And also about the question about conservation and protected areas. How are we sharing the areas with the animals? I like to also think about, you know, like what values are our actions based on? And sometimes I think we take those quite a lot, you know, like for granted. And maybe it's not even clear for us which values our society or system is based upon. Yeah, okay. Looking forward to hear your response, Tom.
Thanks for these second questions. I agree with you that the two options of either viewing and using places exclusively as resources for human demands or setting them aside as conservation areas in which humans should not touch anything and keep out. Those are both unhelpful in many ways options. They're certainly unhelpful if those are the only two options we have about places. But they do both set humans aside still as somehow special and different to all of the other creatures. And the challenge really is a more subtle one about how to live responsibly as part of a more than human group inside these complex relationships. So I think in order to do that, we do have to reject a kind of management mentality as well as a resource extraction mentality. But in rejecting those kinds of approaches, we don't fall into an anything goes kind of approach where we are also no longer responsible for what happens in the environment. So what I think we need instead are approaches to living in more than human worlds that are about humility, that are about accepting that the world isn't ours, either to save or destroy. It's not, can't be about a kind of unilateral human vision for what goes on in places. And of course there is no singular human vision about how to be in any of these places, and it's the views of particular humans as a result of particular political, legal, economic processes that get to dominate and decide which places get set aside and which get exploited. But even insofar as we can think about the needs of humans, of humanity, we are not the only ones, obviously, whose needs and understanding matter. And yet, as earthly inhabitants, like all of the other species on this planet, we will have impacts and we will have ideas about how things might be. So what's required is that we take up those ideas and visions about the world outside of a logic of entitlement, of assumed authority and legitimacy, in which others, both other humans and other species, are required to make all of the sacrifices while their own visions and needs remain permanently secondary to ours. So what's demanded, in short, is the cultivation of new approaches and sensibilities for cohabitation on an earth that's for all of its living forms. So it's about learning to ask a broader set of questions of ourselves and others and to hold open a broader set of possibilities and responsibilities. And your second question, I think, links up to that one really nicely. Because one of the ways in which we craft better places and possibilities for cohabitation is through thinking in more nuanced ways about spaces of shared meaning. So the work that we do is really about conservation in worlds of shared meaning. Is about basically grounded in the recognition that it's not just humans who make meaning in the world, but animals and plants and others do it in a whole range of other interesting ways. Traditionally, of course, though, where that's been studied with non-humans, it's the domain of the behavioural sciences in one form or another, whether it's ethology or behavioural ecology or cognitive biology. And when it comes to humans, of course, that job is allocated to the humanities and social sciences. So how do we bring those conversations together to think about how multi-species communities are taking form, where humans and non-humans are learning about one another and responding to one another in dynamic ways? And that's particularly important in the context of the Anthropocene, where environments are changing rapidly, often for a whole range of different reasons, and different species, different human groups are thrown into new combinations, into new relationships with one another, and need to often learn to live with one another. So one really, I think, neat example of that from my own work in Australia is thinking about how crows live in urban environments. And so crows, especially in Brisbane, but to some extent in other cities too, are changing the ways they live. They're learning to nest in new places, especially on buildings and in windowsills and things, rather than in the trees that they normally nest in. And they're learning to eat new things, to raid bins, and sometimes even cooperating with one another to pull stuff out of bins and get it all on the footpath and eat it. And they're learning to, you know, to eat strange new foods of all kinds that they're brought into contact with. But those kinds of changes in their ways of living are also causing problems of a whole range of different kinds. One of the most obvious ones is swooping, our crows have started to swoop at people, to dive bomb them, if you like, which is something they've never done before. And the scientists think that they've learnt this from magpies. We have different magpies in Australia, not at all related to Eurasian magpies, they just share the same name. But same common name, but they swoop and they often hit people in the head and cause injuries and sometimes deaths. But it's something that our crows have never done, but it's something that some of our crows are starting to do. So a whole range of different ways in which crows are taking advantage of and responding to shifting environments. And of course people's behaviour is changing too, not just swooped sometimes, but also because they now might have crows living on their windowsill, nesting on their windowsill. And so we're asking people to think about how they respond to crows, how they make food available to them or don't, how we cut down really good nesting trees, which pushes crows into closer proximity to people in lower trees, so they have to build their nest lower when they nest in trees still, and that stresses them, and so they're more likely to swoop. And so how are all of the different behaviours of humans, from, you know, what we do with our rubbish to our urban planning, intersect in complex ways with crows' efforts to get on in this changing environment. And the real question is, what would management look like if we didn't think about it as wildlife management anymore, but started to think about it as something more like an art of cohabitation that's drawing in all of this complexity of human and non-human values, meanings and behaviours, and asking how we can inhabit this space better to the extent that we control it, because we don't control the animals. We don't control the humans or the non-humans. And so it's about new forms of dialogue, new ways of communicating and imagining collectively across species what it would look like to live well here.
Very good answer. It's very good.
cold. We have a little dessert for the ones that, even though it's over 8, so if you feel like a little dessert, it's coming very soon. Or shall we just go down there and they can have it there?
Yeah.